Welcome to History 605, South Dakota State Historical Society's podcast, where we talk to historians, curators, filmmakers, artists, and authors about how they interpret the past.
10,000 years from now, I think we can meditate and wonder whether our descendants, because I think they'll still be here, what they will think about us. And let us hope that at least they will give us the benefit of the doubt.
I'm Dr. Ben Jones, South Dakota State Historian and Director of the State Historical Society. Join me and our guests as we think historically.
So it is most appropriate and fitting that in our first year of our second century that this should also be a year of reconciliation between the Indian people and the non-Indian people alike.
History 605 is sponsored by the Gruver Family Trust and done in partnership with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Welcome to the show.
Welcome to History 605. Today on the show, we are going to talk about, and by we, I mean Braidman and I, are going to discuss the Homestake Mine and its impact on South Dakota's history. The mine had a large impact in many ways due to the commodity prices, particularly with gold. It had an impact on the nation's monetary policy and how it carried it out. It had an impact on the development of labor practices and labor unions and labor policy and ultimately right to work, which is enshrined in South Dakota's constitution. And so it's kind of a lot to cover here over a century of mining and with the gold and so forth. But Braidman, welcome to History 605 and thanks for joining me again.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was a really interesting topic to dig into. Admittedly, being from northeastern part of the state, you don't really hear much about the Homestake mine over there. So very excited to get to research this and learn a little bit about the West River mines.
Of course, the discovery of gold, in reality's sakes, people often attribute it to Custer. Custer wasn't necessarily the first one who thought there might be gold there. In fact, Custer went there because the rumor was there was gold, and there was a pretty good confirmation of that from previous U.S. Army map-making and expeditions in the 1850s. Major Long and other, he might have been the only one that went through the area, made some maps. They weren't very good maps. And so after the Civil War and with the railroads coming west and relations with the different tribes and resulting in various treaties, particularly the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1851, and then the one that had the most implications and was the 1868 treaty, kind of sorted out where the Lakota, the Cheyenne, the Crow, the Mandan, Hidatsa, Pawnee, and so forth would have rights to hunt and rights to live and where their reservations would be and so forth. But something sets all that kind of aside very abruptly in 1873.
There's the Panic of 1873. We have a collapse of some railroad construction firms, and it kind of sets North America and Europe into a economic depression.
So people
are looking for ways to find money quick, and what better way than gold?
Yeah, we call them depressions now. Back then, they called them panics, and they were a panic because there was a run on the bank. The banks would, or bank depositors, got the word through the rumor mill or face-to-face that their bank was closing and that their deposits in the bank would then be lost forever. And so that would create a panic. Everyone would run to the bank to get their funds. And 1873 was, you mentioned the railroads. This was 1873 panic. It's probably caused by a drop in land prices in Europe and the United States, ultimately kind of spread a contagion. Banks that had been loaning money based on these real estate and property ownings and so forth then found themselves in bad shape. Some closed. This set off a panic. And that really kind of set the table for an army expedition the very next year. And I think it's important to hold on a bit and try and understand when there's a monetary crisis and the money is based on the price of gold, you can solve your monetary crisis by just getting more gold. And so mining in the American West becomes, particularly gold mining, becomes a way to solve the monetary crisis. We today, when we have a monetary crisis, the Federal Reserve just creates more dollars, or the U.S. Treasury, or both of them, or Congress, or something, there's some type of governmental activity that just creates more dollars. But there wasn't that mindset or view on how monetary policy worked in the 1870s. And so with the dollar being scarce and banks closing and the country needing more gold, and the rumor that there was gold in the Black Hills, 7th Cavalry's ordered to do an expedition into the Black Hills for ostensibly for the purposes of finding a location for a fort. But Custer takes along a geologist and some newspaper reporters, and the next thing you know, the East Coast and Minneapolis and Milwaukee and Chicago, by the summer, late August of 1874, spreading the word that there's gold in them thar hills.
It's kind of incredible how immediate that information gets back and people jump on it. Because we'll see within a year or two of the expedition, there's already miners flooding into the hills.
Right. 1875, near where Custer first found gold, according to him, what is today the town of Custer. There's miners entering, the army kicks them out, and the army is just too strapped, too small to keep people out. And ultimately, the next year, President Grant decides he's not going to use the army to keep the miners out. Instead, he's going to use the army to put the Lakota and the Cheyenne back on their reservations. This kicks off the war that ultimately leads to Custer's defeat and death at Little Bighorn. And ironically enough, there's a bill going through Congress to make it illegal for a non-Indian to kill a female buffalo in the territories. This passed the House the previous year, passed the Senate the previous year. It was pocket vetoed by Grant for reasons that nobody really knows. The sponsoring congressman tries it again. It passes the House again and is up in the Senate committee. The Battle of Little Bighorn happens, and the whole effort dies. It's interesting to note what might have happened had Little Bighorn not gone the way it did. But in any event, it does. And by 1877, the Manny-Penny Agreement passes Congress, and Congress decides to abrogate the treaty, which is a fancy word for breaking, the Treaty of 1868, and in effect take the Black Hills out of the Dakota, or the Great Sioux Reservation, as they call it at the time. So now in 1877, 1878, the miners are pouring into Deadwood and Lead, and Rapid City is growing, and Custer and so forth. But this is a mining of a certain sort. What kind of people are showing up then in Deadwood in 1876, 1877?
These prospectors are coming to just stake claims on mines, try and throw up a bunch of claims. It's kind of like throwing a dart in the dark and just trying to see what you hit.
Mm-hmm.
And so eventually, Fred and Moses Manuel stake a claim on what is now known as the Home Stake deposit. Yep. That happens in April of 1876. And this one is kind of working out for them in a way that it didn't for a lot of other folks.
Right. And you see then a certain gentleman show up. Who comes in there and makes the Manuel brothers an offer they can't refuse?
Yeah. In October of 1877, George Hurst makes his way over and offers to buy the mine along with Lloyd Tevis and James Ben Hagen. Mm-hmm. They purchase it for $70,000 and create the Home Stake Mining Company.
They're not going to be a bunch of guys panning gold in the creek, are they? This is a different kind of deal.
No, this is going to be a larger operation that's going to focus on taking as much sediment out as they can and extracting that gold.
Which requires a lot of, heavy machinery.
Which isn't easily accessible in the hills at this time.
Right. There's no railway to Deadwood Weed in 1877. There's no, there's wagons and stagecoaches and horses, of course, but getting heavy equipment in there is going to be quite an operation. what's Hearst's background? Why does he have all this wherewithal to be able to afford transporting this heavy equipment into Lead?
Hearst has been in the mining purchasing operation for a while at this point. He has holdings throughout the Southwest, California. He's a speculator, might be a good word to describe mm-hmm. him. This is where he's made his bread and butter.
He does seem to have a nose for what would be an effective mine operation, though, and he hires people who also and are able to see whether the geology, the type of stone that's there might pan out, literally.
Yeah.
He brings in heavy equipment, the know-how, the mining operations, and he's got the investment money to be able to expand the operation and get it going. He also lists the Homestake Mine in January of 1879. It goes on the New York Stock Exchange. So he takes the company public. It's the first mining company ever listed on the stock exchange. It's kind of amazing. You think that the 49ers in California, of which Hearst is kind of a part of by that time, would have taken that public. But this is the Homestake is the first one to go public.
Well, and he initially, as we noted, they're mostly investors and speculators at this point. So they hire a superintendent. Samuel McMasters is the first one, but mm-hmm. his tenure is pretty short, all things considered. He dies in 1884, and that allows Thomas Greer to take control, Thomas J. Greer, to become the second and one of the longest reigning superintendents of the Homestake Mine.
Yes, and I guess controversial perhaps to some, loved by others, certainly yeah. A key point in the community in Lead and around the Northern Hills and what he's able to do. And he sets a precedent in a lot of ways. Thomas Greer is operating in the 1890s and early 20th century when labor unions are really beginning to coalesce around workers' rights and union rights, striking and so forth. President McKinley, President Teddy Roosevelt, President Taft, Congress at one point, governors and mayors are often confronted with strikes that mean a lack of coal. In some cases, Teddy Roosevelt has to deal with a really politically touchy situation with the coal strike in 1904 or so. And so unions are beginning to get organized and flex their muscle. And unions are the bane of Thomas Greer's existence, perhaps, in some way, shape, or form. But he seems to be a fairly benevolent guy in a lot of ways, too.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting, too, because already by 1890, Homestake is becoming a large operation. They have 1,500 men processing up to 700 tons of ore throughout 80 different claims a day. You know, 650 yeah. stamps are going every day, all day. This is already a large operation by then.
Yeah.
And you need a lot of labor, frankly, to keep those mines running 24 hours a day.
Yeah, it's very labor intensive to sort out. And chemicals are used and stamping. You mentioned these mills, these heavy machines that have to physically separate the gold from the other ore that's coming out. A lot of granite, mm-hmm. a lot of iron, a lot of things that might also have value in and of themselves. There might be silver, there might be other precious metals from time to time, and you'd have to kind of pull that out. And this is a complicated process. It's a very filthy process, hazardous process, not only down in the mine, but also the chemicals that are used to separate what you want from what you don't want. And then you have to haul off what you don't want, and it can be a pretty filthy business.
Right. Well, and not to run away from the question of labor, but it seems like Greer had a fairly decent relationship with the workers.
Yeah.
It was the unions that he really clashed with
in a
significant way, which is kind of strange to separate the worker from the union. But
right. Right. I think the unions, in this case, and probably many others, would come at it from their national perspective or maybe a regional perspective for their initiatives, their efforts, their goals, and so forth would be set kind of up the chain in the union level management. And your point about the workers, Greer's concern about the workers in lead, the workers at the mine that he's running. And so many times there were differences between the union and the workers at the Homestake mine workers anyway. Point out some of the things that, well, first off, I guess one of the things I thought was amazing about Greer is twice there are fires that start down in the mine.
Yeah.
And in both cases, Greer's down there fighting the fire right alongside the rest of them.
Right.
And I can't imagine going down in a hole hundreds of feet deep at the time. It wasn't to the scale that it will ultimately get to, but hundreds of feet deep with chemicals, very little light, not enough light. You never get enough light. And by the way, there's horses down there too. Because of the lack of machinery, it was easier to get some horses down there to pull things and work machinery around. In both these cases, they fight the fires and they have to ultimately give up, get everybody out of there, and then flood the mine with water to put the fire out. Basically decommissions the mining operation for months, because then you got to pump a lot of water out of there.
Yeah, well, and so the first fire takes place, not early on, but I think in the 1890s.
Right.
Relatively late. But the second fire takes place even later than that, so you've dug deeper, you've got more expensive equipment down there. It's a mess. But they do learn from the fires. So the first fire spurs them to label the shafts, so that way they know
How to get around.
Where the fires that they can communicate that properly.
Right.
I mean, I would hate to be in that position to make that call. All right, do we flood it? Do we think we can get it under control? Because you're looking at millions of dollars being stuck in the ground for the next year.
Yeah, and well, as the lives that could be along on the line during the fire, but then also the time and the danger you'd have to go through to reestablish a safe, relatively safe mining operation. We've kind of left out old George, though. What's happened to him?
Yeah, George Hirst will end up passing away, and that would be in 1891. February 1891, George Hirst passed away.
So Thomas Greer then reports to his wife, Phoebe. So Phoebe Hirst is the owner of the mine for the rest of her life. And then ultimately, well, and of course, people may recognize the Hirst name as from the newspaper. So William Randolph Hirst inherits this fortune from his father and his mother, and then goes on to be newspaper publisher and very influential American throughout into the 20th century. But certainly by the time of the 1920s and 1930s, a lot of this wealth is fueling the Hearst newspaper empire as it's grown.
Well, and as much as the Hearst bring in, the Homestake brings in, Phoebe is very philanthropic.
Correct.
She's constantly giving back to the community. They build the union hall for the workers, which allows them to meet. They build a kindergarten, different recreation areas throughout her life. It's
the opera hall.
The opera hall. It's an interesting outlier, I think, in terms of the relationships that you see, especially during this time, where the workers seem to generally get along pretty well with the management. Management is interested in not only turning a profit, but also making sure that their workers are well taken care of.
It's not the robber baron kind of stereotype that you might think. And in fact, in 1910, President Taft visits the mine. He's the only serving president to actually go to lead and visit the mine. And I think it's a recognition that mining operations like this are part and parcel of the nation's economy, the basis of the dollar. And labor relations with such an entity like this mine is pretty key to keeping the economy at the national level healthy.
Well, and speaking of the national level, the Homestake mine is also pretty influential with the Forest Service. To run this mine, they've been having to cut down a lot of trees in the Black Hills to power their machinery, and we find out that maybe that wasn't quite kosher. So they're one of the first groups to strike a timber agreement with the federal government to regulate the harvest of trees on public land.
Yeah.
And that happens in 1897.
Yeah, 1897. The Department of Ag creates the Forest Service, or I should say the United States creates the Forest Service in the Department of Ag in 1905. And agriculture then, there's almost the implication that the Department of Ag is recognizing that lumber and trees are a commodity for the purpose of generating power in the form of electricity, which at this time was brand new. There's not a lot of things that are electrified. So it's bringing electricity, as well as the railroads. By this time, there's a railroad line that arrives in the 1893-94 timeline into Lead and Deadwood, largely driven by the need to connect all of this to the nation's economy, the gold mine specifically. It's worth pointing out that the way Thomas Greer handled worker relations is notable, and the right that he kept fighting for people to be hired regardless of union membership. That's where he always seems to be able to win out over the union, is his ability to fight for people to get a job, because the unions kept demanding that only members be hired. Mm-hmm. And that was the point upon which ultimately South Dakota would agree with Greer that. And in 1946, South Dakota becomes a right-to-work state, one of the first right-to-work states in the Union, and that's established in its Constitution. In fact, in the Bill of Rights is part in the Constitution. It's the right to work is the Second Amendment in South Dakota's Bill of Rights in our Constitution, which then is passed by the people of South Dakota in 1946 and comes into law in 47. So Greer is able to kind of thread that needle, avoid the union control while still taking care of the miners and the workers, at least up to the standard that they would be willing to be paid and treatment and so forth. And of course, I can't imagine what mine safety standards might look like in a time like 1910, but with no electricity and horses down in the mines and all of that kind of stuff. It's just kind of crazy to think of.
Workers were given 3 candles for their 10-hour shift, and
yeah.
Hope you don't run out.
Yeah, yeah. And ultimately becomes the second deepest mine in North America. The Ross Shaft. So shafts go down, drifts go across in the mine lingo, and the Ross Shaft starts sending up ore in 1934. It goes down to 5,000 feet by 1956. And then a couple guys get a crazy idea about something completely different that mine can be used for. A theoretical physicist at Caltech does some chalkboard thinking about the nature of what's going on in the nuclear reactions in the sun, and thinks that there must be a particle that would represent that. And this gentleman's name is John Bacall, a chemist by the name of Raymond Davis, then proposes doing an experiment in the mid-60s, put in a big tank of petrochloride in the mine at the 4850 level to catch the neutrinos. Now, Brent, do you know why you would have to go so deep to catch those neutrinos?
Well, because those are the only things that are going to penetrate that deep.
Yeah, that's what they're thinking.
That's the remnants.
Mm-hmm. The Earth's crust essentially is a filter. It filters out everything else, or most of everything else. And so they could capture the neutrinos in order to study their nature. And they discover from that, then over time, it figures out that neutrinos have 3 different phases. This goes on into the 1990s, where they're doing these neutrino experiments. And ultimately, Raymond Davis gets the Nobel Prize in Physics. Mm-hmm. Not bad.
Not bad at all.
Yeah. But in 1971, things begin to change again. The Nixon administration gets a law passed that takes the U.S. off the gold standard. And immediately there's the fear among the miners and among the people who lead the operation and the homestake executives and so forth, that this is going to be a seismic change, because ever since the middle of the 19th century, the dollar was pegged to the price of gold. But now if that's divorced from the price of gold, people are not real clear what's going to happen. But it kind of sends over time a long, slow, 3 decades or so long decline in the price of gold, coupled with the depth that they have to continue to go to find more. And by the mid-1980s or so, they're down 8,000 feet, 300 miles of shafts, drifts, and workings. And the expense of gold is no longer worth the price. And so in 1998, the Monday after the Super Bowl, as one miner described it, Black Monday, they came in and they laid off 350 people. Mm. And he was one of them in January of 1998. Now, what's the governor's office going to do about all this in response to this? You can't have 350 people laid off in the Northern Black Hills without political repercussions. So,
right. Well, it's becoming challenging. You've got this big drift. Well, you've already been running science experiments in there. Why not continue? Why not keep offering it up? And so as the mine is eventually shut down in the early 2000s, people get thinking, well, we ought to still use this. This is a perfectly mm-hmm. workable lab.
Yep.
Or that can be turned into a lab. And so in 2004, Governor Rounds and the legislature create the SD Science and Technology Authority.
Yeah, Raymond Davis and other scientists came to Governor Rounds and said, there's got to be something we can do. And Governor Rounds is the kind of person that, he's a guy who loves new ideas. And in my conversations with him, the 3 or 4 I've had over the years, and certainly reading about him, it's clear that Rounds, this is the kind of thing that Governor Rounds would just figure out, I think there's got to be something we can do. Not only do you want the jobs back, but just the science alone would be something that would interest him. And so, yeah, 2004, he gets the state legislature to create the South Dakota Science and Technology Authority. And then in 2006, they announced that Denny Sanford is going to donate $70 million. Barrick Gold Mines, which owns the mine at the time, donates the land, and the state of South Dakota commits $40 million. And they start getting the mine back into some type of shape in order to be able to do these deep underground experiments. And unfortunately, though, the water table has risen inside the mine. Part of the issue, yeah. And Greer and everybody fought that kind of stuff when they started getting deep into the mine. So it has to be dewatered, as they would say, and that is completed in 2009. And then in 2011, the Department of Energy, via the Lawrence Livermore National Lab, supports the operations. Now, Lawrence Livermore National Lab, that ought to be a name that South Dakotans ought to know, particularly Lawrence, particularly Ernest Lawrence, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist who grew up in Canton and Pierre, went to USD, created the cyclotron, got his Nobel Prize for that, but was also heavily involved in the Manhattan Project in World War II, and then a lot of the nuclear research that was going on in the 1950s after World War II was over. And so Ernest Lawrence, his name graces that lab. That's where he spent his professional career, most of it. And so it's kind of coming home for the Lawrence Livermore National Lab to support something going on with South Dakota. And now the experiments down there, they're all at the 4850 level. And one of the experiments that I think is one of the more interesting ones, they're still catching neutrinos and they're doing various things with particle physics. But the one that's under construction now, they've just removed a lot more earth and ore out of there, created a space for another experiment called DUNE, Deep Underground Neutrino Experiment, and people at Fermilab near Chicago will shoot neutrinos through the Earth to the surf. No tunnel needed. They're shooting the particles through there, and they'll catch them at the other end underneath Leeds, South Dakota. And this will continue to inform our understanding of particle physics, nuclear explosions, how energy works, dark matter, matter, and all that stuff that I can't even begin to understand. But and so now there's no more gold being mined there. It hasn't since 2001 or so, but hopefully they're finding out stuff about the nature of matter itself.
Yeah, it's amazing how Homestake has helped to propel the science and engineering fields into the modern day, but also back when it was up and operational, you know, helping to establish the South Dakota School of Mines and Technology. I don't think people realize how important Homestake has been to South Dakota's advancements in science.
Yeah. Yeah, the mining engineering departments at the School of Mines was started to help people understand the geology and the mining engineering that's needed to run mines such as Homestake. And that school today certainly continues to produce really highly qualified engineers and do very well and be part and parcel of mines all over the world and a lot of different engineering issues all over the world. So that the Black Hills geology kicks off, but it's also kind of appropriate that when the gold standard was important, the mine was important, and when the dollar was no longer pegged to the gold, the mine became gold itself, and the mine in particular became less important to the American economy, at least right. At the broad scale.
Although you had mentioned that a new company has bought area around the mine,
right?
To hopefully continue.
Yeah, well, we'll see what happens. Dakota Gold Corp bought the mine in 2022, and they're doing studies now. There's an open pit mine. If you travel up to Lead, near the visitor center, which tells the story of the mine and has a large and growing educational mission as a part of the Sanford Underground Research Facility's overall education emphasis. Right by there is an open pit mine, and Dakota Gold is purchased the mining rights in 2022, and they're doing studies now. They're traded on the New York Stock Exchange, and well, we'll see where that goes. It is kind of just a way to sum up then. It's that mine has been part and parcel of Black Hills economy, labor relations, the Black Hills experience, the miners and so forth, and the stories, which can be told in a book called The Price of Gold, recently out and created by Aaron Lauren Woodward and Nick Hubbard, where they have oral history interviews of miners and some fairly harrowing tales. If you're interested in that, you can check that out. I think there's a page online where you can go and find that book. It's got some really great stories from the miners themselves and their experiences. The danger, what they liked about working down there, what they didn't, and the kind of people that they are, and the kind of experiences that they had.
I highly recommend that people check out An Iron Hand in a Velvet Glove, Thomas J. Greer's Management of the Homestake Mine. The article is written by Susan Richards and Rex Myers. Really summer, interesting read.
Yeah, summer 2008 in the South Dakota History Journal. That's also very good. And then we were able to find the details about this in various scientific journals about the geology of the mine and so forth. So lots of good stuff out there. And it's certainly from the Opera House to the library and the culture in the Northern Black Hills. Homestake Mine is part and parcel of that for 125 years. Thanks a lot, Brayden.
Yep, thanks for having me.
We'd like to thank Howard and Dorothy Gruver for their passion for history and the support of the South Dakota State Historical Society. It's through gifts such as theirs that we're able to tell South Dakota's history.
When a tornado hits a town, I've never been able to figure out which houses were the Democrats, or the Republicans, or the Libertarians. I never knew who the Norwegians were, the Swedes. or the Czechoslovakians or the Germans. Of course, everybody wants to point out who the Irish are, but other than that...
History 605 is produced by the South Dakota State Historical Society, and its audio engineer is the amazing Kevin Larson. We'd like to thank our partner, South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and most importantly, we'd like to thank you for listening. Please rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to fine podcasts. We'll be back in a couple weeks with another episode of History 605.